And if Europe doesn't want these fine, amazing founders, come to Austin. I'll take you to 3 different barbecue joints. We'll hang out, come by the ranch. Entrepreneurs from Europe, beautiful here. Cost of living's half of any city in Germany. Tons of young people, tons of freedom. You can get a gun, you can get a ranch, you can get a horse.
Alex, I've never been invited to this trip.
You're invited. Consider yourself invited. Come anytime.
We'll do a crossover taping anytime you're ready.
I don't know if we're letting people from the UK in the country right now. We'll have to see.
This Week in Startups is brought to you by Lemon.io. Get access to Lemon Hire, a platform with more than 80,000 pre-vetted engineers that you can interview within 48 hours. Get $2,000 off your first hire at lemon.io/hire today. Squarespace. Turn your idea into a new website. Go to squarespace.com/twist for a free trial. When you're ready to launch, use offer code TWIST to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. And CLA. Innovation takes balance. CLA CPAs, consultants, and wealth advisors can help you get from startup to where you want to end up. Get started now at claconnect.com/tech.
All right, everybody, welcome back to This Week in Startups. He's Alex Wolfe. I'm Jason Calacanis. And Monday, Wednesday, Fridays, typically at noon Texas time, but today a little early because I'm heading out with my daughters for ski week. Yeah, woo! Very excited for ski week, yes. 24 days right now, Alex. Going to try to get in 9 days. 9 okay. plus 24 is over 30. I think it's, in fact, 33. So if I get 32 in 33 days, then I am within spitting distance of my 41 ski day goal. Now, I don't want to exaggerate, Alex. These are 2 or 3 hour ski days. I'm not out there for 8 hours. I do the executive program. I'm the executive old man program.
Well, good, because I'm hoping to do a couple of shows with you next week. And if you're out doing 10-hour days on the slopes, it's going to be tough to have you call in. So,
yeah, calling in for the lift. Hopefully this year I don't get trapped on a lift. Last year I got trapped on a lift for about, a full 15, 20 minutes. And I decided I would tweet it. And then, of course, you know, everybody's looking for the drama. So everybody was like, do we need to call, you know, the mountain to rescue you or whatever? And I'm like, no, there's 10,000 people on this, there's thousands of people on this mountain. They're quite aware that this lift is not working and people are doing shots while they wait.
Yes, I can see that going one of two ways. I've been on a lot of ski lifts. Sometimes if the weather's nice and you can see for a distance and it's clear, I mean, I wouldn't mind 15 minutes of sightseeing. I've also been on lifts when it's been driving snow, you know, horizontal, and that would be miserable.
This was during a beautiful flurry. So it was beautiful, but yeah, when you got two daughters on the lift with you, they're ready to go. So, So what do we got on the dock? Okay, what do we got? I know we have a great guest today.
We do have a great guest. We have about 15 minutes until they are here. We are dealing with transatlantic time zones. So Jason, I thought we would start with the thing that you and I are most peevish about today. Which is OpenAI's amazing pitch for the future of American AI dominance and why that means we must, I would say, dissolve domestic copyright protections.
Okay. So, yeah, I saw this come across my feed, one of the group chats. OpenAI has published recommendations to the White House Office of Science and Technology for a U.S. AI action plan. I don't want to say something inappropriate here, but this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen. They say here that China won't respect copyright. Yeah, of course, that is like one of our major issues with the country. And they say that's giving them a strategic advantage in the AI game. The fact that Chinese can and do steal American IP gives them an advantage. Yes, this is correct. Also, if you steal gold, if you enslave people in your own country, this also gives you a strategic advantage. You can ask the Uyghurs working in slave labor concentration camps in China today, upwards of 1 million, according to sources. So yes, the Chinese do have some horrible things they do that give them an advantage. Maybe you could read for us what they are actually saying in their own words, they being the OpenAI team.
Yes. So, as Jason said, OpenAI says that, you know, China has an advantage in its ability to benefit from copyright arbitrage. Essentially, they don't have IP protections in the same way that we do, especially about content from outside their borders. And so, if there is a regime in the United States, for example, that is a bit more, I don't know, Jason, economically expensive for AI companies, it could put domestic AI firms at a disadvantage. And the way that OpenAI frames this is essentially by saying that this is a matter of, quote, national security, their words. So it's a big deal.
Yeah, and OpenAI is just a terrible company. I just got to say it right now. They make a great product, but I don't trust this company. And, you know, I'm friendly with Sam, but, you know, I really think Sam has an ethics problem. Obviously, flipping the company from a for-profit to a nonprofit, saying I don't have any equity, now I've got $10 billion, $20 billion in equity. You know, I think there might be, you know, I'm reading into this, a reason why his top leaders have all left and started their own companies. Is because of that ethics challenge that the firm has. Doing this type of thing, you know, using the Chinese and their illegal, immoral behavior as your model and as your excuse to do that here is really low. It's really low. And it's kind of gross, I have to say. We don't set our morality at what a dictatorship halfway around the world does to their people. They're living in a police state, to IP. They're stealing from artists and innovators. Here's an idea.
Okay.
You took a nonprofit, you got to $10 billion in revenue or so, and it's worth $350 billion. Why don't you do what Spotify does? Why don't you do what Apple does, which is pay content creators for using their content? Apple could come out and say, gosh, Tim Cook, they don't pay for music over in China. They steal it. They sell it on street corners, you know, on thumb drives. Every song ever created. There's millions of websites in Russia that will restream all of the live feeds of the MMA fights and sports and stuff like that. Yeah, there's all kinds of ways to steal content. I don't think that means we should do it that way. You should pay. Spotify pays. So pay us, content creators, and create a sustainable model. It's ridiculous. And then also creating all this regulation is a way to kill startups. So Sam is playing dirty. I'm not surprised. I'm disappointed, obviously, but I'm not surprised. And I think Sam needs to really think this through a little bit better.
I think there's another element in OpenAI's pitch here that I think is actually a little bit pernicious. So one thing they also said, and I'm going to pull this up on screen here. America has so many AI startups, attracts so much investment, and has made so many research breakthroughs, largely because the fair use doctrine promotes AI development. In other markets, it's different. For example, the EU has created, quote, text and data mining exceptions with broadly applicable, quote, opt-outs for any rights holder. This makes things more unpredictable. This sounds to me like not only does OpenAI want to have very, very permissive use of copyright materials rules, but also wants to say that rights holders should not have the ability to opt out of being included in AI datasets. And that's going from saying that your copyright doesn't matter. It's saying that your copyright doesn't matter and I have a right to take your stuff without your permission. So it seems slightly more vicious, Jason.
It's very simple. You're not wrong. If YouTube wants to take This Week in Startups, which we host on YouTube, and they want to train their AI on, and I don't have a problem with that, send me a little message in the interface. Would you like to opt in to Gemini? We'll index. And here are the terms and conditions. It's a 1 year. It's a 10 year. It's an infinite license. It's a 100-year license. And we'll pay you this amount. And just give me a dollar amount. I say yes. I say no. Let's say you get 10% of people. Maybe that's enough to train your API. And I said no. So I got none of that money. And the AI went off to the races. Maybe I say yes, and I'm one of the people who gets there. Maybe if only 1% say yes, they've got to raise the price to, you know, $2 an hour of content, whatever it is.
Oh, no.
Come up with a number.
Yes.
And that's called the free market. It's called respecting IP. And you know what? Sam Altman was the first person to complain when DeepSeek stole their model and did reinforcement learning. So you really, like, talk about hypocritical. OpenAI and Sam Altman's the height of hypocrisy. I know I'm getting myself into a Parmalucky situation here where people are going to clip this and say I'm like dunking on somebody. No, I'm calling balls and strikes. If you don't like it, tune into another program. Balls and strikes. Sam complained when his content, his IP was stolen. Now he's lobbying. Founders, let's be real. Let's keep it a buck. Finding great developers is hard. It's like one of the hardest things you have to do in our industry, especially when you're trying to run and scale your startup
But here's the good news. I got a tip that's going to save you time, money, and a ton of headaches. You need to check out Lemon.io. Lemon.io has thousands of on-demand developers who can help you. They have done all the work to find and vet great developers who are experienced, who are results-oriented, and who charge competitive rate. Great developers, we know, are hard to find and integrate into your team, so Lemon.io will handle all of that for you. They're only going to offer you hand-picked developers with at least 3 years of experience. And if something goes wrong, Lemon.io will find you a replacement developer ASAP. A bunch of launch founders have worked with Lemon.io, and they have told me they've had a great experience. So here's your call to action. Go to lemon.io/twist and find your perfect developer or an entire tech team in 48 hours or less. And Twist listeners get 15% off the first 4 weeks. So stop burning money. Hire developers smarter. Visit lemon.io/twist. Did he give a donation to Trump?
I forget if it was personal or corporate, but I believe there's $1 million.
Please. I believe he decided he would throw in $1 million to Trump. I don't know if that was personally or from OpenAI.
According to this, it was Sam Altman of OpenAI as opposed to OpenAI's Sam Altman.
Okay, great. So Sam Altman paying $1 million. Here's my note. I don't know if I know anybody involved in AI in the new Trump administration.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what they should do. If there was somebody, like a leader in the administration, like, dare I say, a czar of AI.
Oh, interesting. I think we have one of those.
Yeah. Yes. So if I ever met him, I'd say, don't fall for it. It's a trap. Sam Altman is giving $1 million to Trump, to his inauguration fund, to try to buy his way out of a New York Times lawsuit. That's what's happening here.
Yes. Yes.
They're trying to figure out that, what's cheaper? The $1 billion judgment they'll get against them from the New York Times. I think it could be $1 billion judgment against them. Certainly nine figures. And that's a speeding ticket for a $350 billion company, but it's a precedent. Every single content company that hears my voice, Bob Iger from Disney, General Zaslav, General Zod from Warner Brothers Discovery, anybody, Rupert Murdoch, I'm calling like all the media leaders, the super friends of content, as it were, the Justice League, get together and then crush OpenAI with lawsuits. Crush them with an infinite number of lawsuits. Every single infraction you find, file a lawsuit on behalf of that content creator. So you don't have to just do a Disney one. And I'm not saying lawfare here. I'm saying fair law. You know, they could get together, put a pool of $100 million together and say any creator who feels that they have their content stolen and has proof of it, please send it to us and we will file on behalf of them. You know how Peter Thiel did this, like, back the lawsuit?
With Gawker and Hulk Hogan.
You know, this is a new method of helping people who can't afford, whether you agree with it or not, can't afford, you know, the sustained $10, $20 million you need to protect your copyright or protect your rights. This would be a way to do that.
I think the disgruntlement you're describing, I think, matters because people say, okay, Jason and Alex, you guys are clearly, you know, you have a history in media. You guys are biased here. What about the links? What about the sources? Well, I was reading this morning, the Tollbit, a Twist 500 company, Q4 AI bot executive report. And I found a very interesting stat that I'm going to share with everybody. From the report, they says that despite AI search companies' claims, Tollbit sees that AI bots on average are driving 96% less click-through traffic than trad Google search. So what we are supposed to do is give away our information, let someone else use it for free, make money off it, and then give us nothing back. And to me, there is no part of the value chain here that is functional for people who make content, make media, make words. And so to me, Sam Altman's argument is inherently self-defeating. Even if you grant his point, what you're going to do is rip the carpet out from underneath people who make the words he needs next year to train his models.
It's short-term greed. It's just greed. And it's selfish on behalf of OpenAI. They're being selfish and greedy.
Yes.
If you screw content creators, how are you going to feed the LLM next year, 10 years from now? It's very simple. Be a leader, Sam. Be a leader, OpenAI. You're the leader in the space. You're a top 10 website. Come up with a plan to pay content creators. It's not difficult. Put out a shingle. You can work. There's a half dozen companies. We have an investment in one. that are doing clearing rights. I'm not going to plug any specific one here, but there'll be plenty of ways for you to say to an author like myself, hey, the book Angel's dope. I want to license it. How do you feel about a 3-year license? How do you feel about a 10-year? You know what? I will tweet. I will send traffic to you. Set the precedent that content creators deserve to be paid and respected. Because I can tell you, OpenAI wants their IP protected. They're the first ones crying foul when the Chinese stole their content. So yeah. I am going to name a new disgraziad.com. Please, Heidi, on my team, forward disgraziad.com to this OpenAI document. Thank you. And I'll end my rant here. Or you can, to the clip of this on the Twist Clip channel, even better. Disgraziad.com. We have a guest here. I really love our next guest. He's a hard worker. He's a salt of the earth guy.
All right. So Wednesday, Jason and I were talking about Project Europe. I was very excited by this. I thought it was very bullish. Jason was a little bit skeptical of the dollar amount and the focus. So what we did is we dragged Harry Stebbings, the founder of Project Europe. You know him from 20 Minute VC, the show, 20 VC, the venture firm. Let's bring Harry up. Harry.
Howdy, guys.
Here he is.
Harry. There he is. Hey,
my guy. How you doing, Harry?
There we go. Time. It is lovely to see you both. And Alex, I don't think you know this, but Jason gave me the most seminal advice in content 8 years ago. He said, it's a simple game. It's a game of who can survive the longest. Mm. Just keep going. Yeah. And genuinely, it is probably some of the best advice I've ever been given in content. And I continuously think back to it when times are hard.
Yeah, it's never easy, is it? 20 Minute VC, great program. And Harry has a great fund and he invests a whole bunch. And, you know, it's a lot of people take notes and then they don't ever like give any credit to the people. Maybe they took some notes from. You've always been like a gentleman about that. And I have to as well, because where I got that piece of advice was when I convinced Peter Rojas to leave Gizmodo.
Wow.
Because Nick Dungeon. I've got supervillains on my mind. Other supervillain in this J-Cal extended Marvel universe. In the J-Cal universe, another supervillain is Nick Dungeon, who I'm friendly with. It's kind of like a Batman Joker kind of relationship we have. You complete me. I need you. I don't want you to die, J-Cal.
That's a very good impression.
I need you. They'll throw you away just like they did me.
How did we end up there?
Well, because Nick Denton.
I just want, why so serious? That's what I'm waiting
why
for.
Why so serious, Alex? It's not an S1.
Sadly.
I'm sorry. I would have ruined that. I got 57 sleep score. So he told me, I was like, hey, listen, you got to leave Gizmodo. How much is Denton paying? He's paying me like $12.50 a month. I said, listen, I'll give you equity in Weblogs Inc. and Engadget. You know, Nick promised you equity. He never delivered. I'll give it to you day one. I'll sign the paper right now if you join me. And I'll give you a raise. And I'll give you this new MacBook Air. I had bought 3 or 4 MacBook Airs and I was using them to recruit Blogger because MacBook Air was brand new. You remember when?
Yeah.
He said, yeah. So he joined and, you know, became a millionaire. You know, when we sold it, I gave him a pretty sweet deal. In fact, I raised the deal that I originally had. I could have given him less money, but I was like, he was the key here. He was like the keystone in the portfolio of blogs. He said, I said, what's the secret of blogging? He said, you have to show up every day and then don't stop. Consistency. And then with All In, I said the same thing. I said, listen to the team, you guys got to take this more serious. Every Thursday has to be sacrosanct. Anyway,
yeah.
Long story short.
I did not get 1,000 plays on a show for 2 years. And at one point I was doing one a day, so 5 per week working day, and not 1,000 plays per show for 2 years. I didn't make money for 3 years. I just loved venture, which is why I was friendless for many years.
I always point to you, like I meet young people and they're like, I want to be in venture capital. I'm like, this is a hard place to go. There's not that many seats, right? Yeah. It's a small profession. It's a boutique kind of thing. And they say, okay, well, what do I do? Who do I email? Who can you tell to hire me? I'm like, you can tell the world to hire you. Just do what Harry did. Just start interviewing people, be active on social and say, I want a job in venture. I want to do some venture. And then Harry's like, I don't need to have a job. I'll just start my own goddamn venture firm. You know how hard it is? And you're on your fourth fund right now or third?
Now third. One was 8, 2 was 140, 3 was 400.
Squarespace makes stunning professional websites ridiculously easy. It doesn't matter if you're just selling a product or a service. Maybe you're just sharing your ideas. Maybe you're an artist. Maybe you're a consultant. Squarespace is going to give you all the tools to make this happen. And as you know, Squarespace is always adding cutting edge features. This is why I've been using it for over a decade. And Squarespace is actually the longest running partner here on This Week in Startups, because every time I need a new feature, Squarespace adds it. And the new AI tools are unbelievable. They have one called Design Intelligence. It's like having a world-class designer sitting next to you in your office, and you just answer a couple of questions, and their AI builds you a fully customized site that's perfect for your brand, that's unique to you, and it does it in just minutes. Personalized layouts, on-brand visuals, premium content, it's all ready to go. So start your year off strong at squarespace.com/twist for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/twist to get 10% off your first website or domain purchase. squarespace.com/twist. Thank you to Squarespace for making such a great product that we use year after year at an affordable price. And we really appreciate your partnership.
But I think a lot of people like look at it and want to be me. I was just in a show. And the truth is, you know, I'm an alcoholic. I'm a bulimic. I'm a workaholic. I have heart palpitations. I spend most of the time alone in my head. It's Wait, not always great.
I didn't know we were so similar. Hi. Yeah,
well, Alex, hey, I always thought Alex. We were.
Well, you know what? You know, sometimes I have to say, some of the people I know in my life who have that, including Alex, they're the most thoughtful, courageous, hardworking people. They just need to understand that certain things aren't for them, right? And alcohol's not for you. Alcohol's not for Alex. It's not for anybody. I'll be telling us it's poison, but you know, you just have to know what you're good at and what you're not, and create
it's
a little discipline.
Though, I was literally just with a founder that I think is fantastic and I'd love to try and find a way to invest in. I started the conversation with that, and he said, you know, I've spoken to 50 VCs and they all say, oh, we have a thesis here and we do seed to A and this is how we add value. No one's ever started a call with that. I feel like I've got to know you in a way that I haven't got to know anyone in this process. And I think this is it. People want to buy from people.
Yes.
And at the end of the day, everything touches a consumer and you just have to bluntly be honest and show yourself.
Being human is highly underrated. You can see that in social media. I was like training some people on social media and like they're talking to me and they're like making great insights. And I'm like, okay, now tweet that. And then they get in front of the tweet box and they're like, I'm going to now talk like a marketer. And I'm like, what? How can you text me something so insightful and then when you tweet, you don't? They're like, oh, well, I was trying to write that. I'm like, don't write it, just say it.
Yes.
And then whatever you said, put that in the tweet. They're like, oh, that's how it works. Yeah, be a human.
I have a genuine question for you before we just dive in. I know you want to go. And Jason, you know, you get a lot of heat now, especially with All In and the fame that you have. How do you create emotional barriers to stop it hurting you?
Wow, that's really great. So I grew up in Brooklyn, where you have to survive an onslaught of people telling your mom jokes on the stoop and, you know, just absolutely roasting each other. So when I get roasted, you know, or Palmer Luckey comes and dunks on me or, you know, some people, you know, then his co-investors and his partners try to like dunk on me. I'm just like, oh, these guys are hilarious. Like, who cares? Like the fact that they're even going after a podcast or angel investor, because I said, you know, whatever I said about him and the news reports I read, like, okay, who cares? Like, you want to try to pin me as X, Y, or Z, you know, like, go for it. What's more, much more important is the work you do in the world, right? And so the work you're doing in the world is what's important. If somebody's jealous of you, Harry, which a lot of people are, because, hey, most people can't raise funds. It's hard to raise a fund. And you just keep going out there, doing more episodes, raising more funds. That is tweaking to people, especially if an outsider does it who didn't come, you know, via Harvard Business School, Stanford. That is very, very tweaking for people who are elites to see people come, you know, from the bottom up and then just take their position. So the haters make you greater. The other thing I find with the haters is, you know, in my case, the jaders,
I brand them,
right?
Because they're my jaders.
The jaders are my, as I always said from the beginning of the program, the jaders make me greater. So when Palmer Luckey's dunking on me, you know what? He did make me greater in a way, because now when I do a news story, I'm like, if this is true, I don't assume the news story is true, because he's like, you assume the news story is true. It wasn't true. And I'm like, okay, well, maybe you sue them or whatever. But now I'm like, you know, maybe he's right in that instance. Like, maybe this news story isn't true. Maybe he got setup. Maybe it wasn't as bad as they made it out to be. Because we have seen like some news stories wind up being, you know, whatever, incorrect at a level that maybe is greater. So the haters will make you greater. They typically will say, this person's terrible. I hate them. Here's like a really great insight that would make them better. And then I hate them, kill yourself. And you just have to be willing to take those two, the beginning and the intro and the outro out, and just look for what, maybe they do have a point somewhere in there in their hatred. And that's almost universal. And a lot of times that insult sandwich that I'll get, the meat of it, they might have like a really good coaching tip. You know, it might actually be like, you know, some NBA player saying like, oh, you're too soft, you know, and like, you should have dunked that. And it's like, okay, next time I'll dunk it. You know, next time I'll say, if this report is true, you know, and that actually then becomes a superpower. That becomes a superpower. And that's what you will do. Like, what's the latest insult you got that hit you? Which one stung?
I mean, there's very blunt ones, which I find always humorous, where they're just like, you're a bleep. I think when people really criticize my interviewing style, I really care about the quality of the shows. It is an art to me. And when people say that that is bad, shit, could be done better, or very viciously, obviously I'm kind of sugarcoating it, that upsets me.
Yeah. Interesting. What is it about the interview style that they point out? Do they have like, you interrupt too much, or your sentences are too long?
I interrupt too much.
Yeah. I get that too.
You know, when you're guiding a guest to a particular conversation, you kind of have to shepherd them that way.
Yes. So here's a note for you. This is what I did when people said I was interrupting too much, because sometimes the good piece of feedback in there is when they're listening on their headphones, they're starting to get into a moment where the guest is really cooking and then you are kind of steering the guest, but they want the guest to cook a little more. Just next time you do an interview, put a little stopwatch on the side of your desk and watch it. And then after you finish your question, hit the lap button. And just say, I'm not going to interrupt for a minimum of 1 minute, and then I'm going to let it breathe when they finish for 5 seconds, and then just see if you like it better. It's your show, but you could actually take that as a tip.
I think one of the most important things is actually being comfortable in silence. Often, the moment after silence is when greatness happens. There's a brilliant Elon Musk interview where there's silence, and then he reflects on that, and what comes next is what is so special. And I really think about getting comfortable in those awkward at times silences.
Yeah.
Give people rope.
You're
awesome. That's where the good stuff comes from. But respecting everyone's time, guys, we got to drill this back down. We got to talk about Europe, because this is what I'm a hot trot to talk about. So, Harry, just to be clear, Project Europe, new fund, 10 million euro, going to put 200,000 euros into young EU founders. I think you had 120 people that were going to help provide mentorship to begin with. You tweeted out that there's now another couple of hundred. Lots of questions from the audience and from us about this, but did I miss anything in the outline of your push to rebuild European dynamism?
No, listen, honestly, every day I meet incredible young entrepreneurs in Europe, and I met more and more, and the predominant advice they were getting was, you have to leave Europe. It's shit to build businesses here. You have to go to the US. And it's simply not true. We can build amazing businesses here, and I wanted to fundamentally change the vibes. You can bluntly denigrate the word vibes a lot, but actually just positive vibes is a lot for an ecosystem. And I wanted to change the vibes, let young people know that you can build businesses here and that they don't have to go and leave their families to build a massive business. And Spotify and Revolut and Adyen and all these amazing businesses show that. And that was the genesis.
What is the deal? When I heard the concept, I was like, oh, Peter Thiel fellows in some ways, right? There's 200,000 going to each one. Is it an investment, or is it like Peter Thiel, like a grant with no expectation of return? What is it?
Yeah, no, so it's an investment. I did the studies on basically how grants are used differently to investments. And basically grants are held with less accountability and less responsibility. Not that they're bad. In certain cases, they can be great. But traditionally, that is how they are viewed. It's like when you give free classes, the participation is lower than if they're paid for. And so I thought that an investment would structure it right. It would structure the responsibility and the accountability right for the person who gets it. And
is it a standard deal? Is it like 200K for 5%, 2% for 100%.
It's
what is it?
200K for 6.6%, but there's
Alice. So it's Y Combinator, basically. Same standard deal. Yeah.
Exactly. But there's elasticity around it. If you've got a round that's already happened, that's been preempted, you have to always be willing to move. Elasticity is everything.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the archetypal deal, but absolutely we have the flexibility to move
with
it.
What is the condition? You have to stay in Europe. You have to stay for a certain number of years. Do you have to commit to something, or you just have to be part of the vibes?
Not at all. You need to be in Europe at the time, but you know, restricting someone's personal freedoms on movement would probably be a restriction on human rights. And then
somebody doing it in there's a couple of people in the United States who say, "We'll give you this money. You have to commit to 1 year in the
Wasn't that what you did with Alex? You said you just can't leave the home.
Yes.
You've got to stay in that room.
Lock the door. That's it.
I love the bookshelf. Stay there.
You guys are funny, but literally a story that we're not talking about today is this one from The Information about how now DeepSeek's employees are having their passports taken, and so they can't leave the country. So we joke, but in certain markets, this is how it works.
The world of tech startups is a whirlwind. Man, you gotta navigate financial management, global expansion, and of course, strategic growth. It can feel like plotting a course through uncharted waters, but fear not. CLA is here to cut through the complexity. From entity selection to mergers and acquisitions, they'll elevate your startup journey, simplify your financial management, and they're going to be your navigator. CLA offers a comprehensive suite, including industry-focused wealth advisory, digital solutions, plus audit, tax consulting, and even outsourcing. What sets CLA apart? Their expansive footprint. They have more than 8,500 dedicated professionals across nearly 130 U.S. locations, all driven by a global vision. Their promise is simple: to know you and to help you. CLA is more than an accounting firm. They're your partner to success. So you need to have a trusted advisor by your side, one who's going to help you navigate through all these important tax issues, get your accounting tight, and do everything in between. It's time to take action. Visit claconnect.com/tech. And don't forget to mention that your boy J-Cal sent you. That's claconnect.com/tech. Start today.
Well, they clearly have stronger views than me on that. we do not restrict them in that way. But then also, I wanted to make it not a 20 VC thing, not a me thing, which is why I don't like the articles or the pictures about me. I think people also think I like the attention. I don't. I really don't. I only do the media stuff because I wanted to be an investor and I didn't go to Goldman Sachs and I'm a dropout. I don't actually love being center of attention, like really. And so we hired an amazing CEO who was out of Entrepreneur First, which is bluntly kind of the European accelerator number one. And she's ran a program there for 6 years. She is CEO. She runs it day to day. And hopefully we just empower her to be amazing and build incredible programs.
Okay.
I think it's great to plant the flag because there's a reason why entrepreneurs leave.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why entrepreneurs leave is it is harder to run a business there. Mm-hmm. And so I guess my question to you is, what's true in that belief system that needs to change in Europe? So one of the things you're changing is the vibes. Great. But there's a reason why people come here. There's many more investors. The investors here are qualitatively different. You know that. They take more risk. They've had more big wins. So they're a little more comfortable with failure. Regulations are different in Europe. And in fact, there's, you know, Europe is many different countries with different regulations around employment, et cetera. So if there were two or three things that need to change in Europe to make that valid criticism that it's easier here, what do you need to change? What notes do you take from America?
Listen, the number one thing is access to talent that's seen scale and success. We do not have the same depth of operators that you have in the US that have seen 100 million, 200 million, 300 million, 400 million, we simply do not have that. And so when you hit Series B, C, there is fundamentally a lack of experienced operators who've seen true scale. That takes time. We're seeing more and more, but it is still incredibly prominent as a problem for founders. So I would say absolutely that. Listen, local liquidity markets are completely dead, if we're transparent. You want a statement?
There's no exits there. We have very few here. This is a regulator problem. They want to stop every M&A transaction. It's crazy. And like, they don't understand what they're doing to innovation. If you don't let the little companies get bought by the medium-sized ones and the medium-sized ones merge and the medium-sized ones sometimes, you know, get bought by the big ones, you basically shock the system. You freeze the lake. They're froze the lake.
Jason, the UK blocked Figma.
I mean
it was awful.
Ridiculous. What's the vibes over there about that? Like, it's just like, I told the Figma people, why don't you just block everybody in the UK's IP address from using an Adobe product or Figma and tell them we don't sell the product in your region, therefore you don't have any jurisdiction over it. It's illegal. Our terms of service say English people can't use the product.
But also, we don't have IPO markets. You know, the London Stock Exchange is not what it used to be. It does not hold the same cachet. We don't have the supply side of cash. The local liquidity markets in other, you know, Germany, France are not the same. You have, you know, fantastic market to IPO in.
Such a good IPO market that, I mean, not to toot my own horn about this point, but here's a headline from a week ago. Figma in talks with bankers to explore an IPO this year. This is, Jason and I have been talking back and forth about the Figma Adobe deal for a while. I want to go back to age and experience, because you said there's not a lot of people in Europe or as many in the United States that have built something to scale and know how to run, you know, post Series C. Fair enough. Mm-hmm. The mentorship angle of Project Europe makes a lot of sense to me. But the number one question that I've gotten from folks about this project is the age band around who you're looking for. And I mean, Alex Booker, for example, said that he's interested in the age cap of roughly 18 to 25 that you have. I've seen people call it illegal. What's the thinking there? And can you actually have an age cap under EU regulations?
I think you can. I think it's a theme and a thesis, like any firm has. So again, that's the thesis of the firm. And again, it's like a movement and a company that's run by a CEO, but you know, that's the theme and the thesis. So yes. And then I think it's like, you've got to start somewhere. Great companies have an ICP, in, you know, ideal customer profile. We want to speak to the next generation of builders who will build generational defining businesses. You have to start somewhere. And this is where we start. I think bluntly, the criticism and the negativity that has come from this, let's not shy away from it, is bluntly one of the reasons why Europe is in the situation where we're in, which is because it is easy to throw peanuts from the side and not many people actually put their neck on the line and build. And quite frankly, I can't change policy, Alex. It takes a long time. I'm not smart enough to. I can't change the decline of the German car industry. I can't help the French or the British lack of growth. But I'm trying to do all that I can to encourage teenagers who have a dream to build a business and to give them a mentorship from amazing people. Sorry, Jason.
No, what you're saying is dead on. And I want to just give you a little bit of fuel. I'm taking the other side. If you're English, you're French or German, I'm waiting for you to come to America. I'll help you get the visa. Yes, come here. And so just so Harry knows, he can take this and show it to those peanut gallery people and say, this is what I'm up against. We would love to have you here in America. I literally asked Trump on our program, All In, make sure we get green cards for talented people. The administration gets this. To the people of Europe, we want your smartest. We want your best and brightest. We're coming for them. And if you try to stop Harry from what he's doing here, we love it. We love that you overregulate. We want those talented people. It's a war for talent.
This is what the UK government has forgotten, that we are in a global war for talent, and we are fighting against you, and you have a great product. And we are fighting against UAE, which has an even better product by the day. They will pay for a lot of your costs. We have to be very strategic in retaining our best talent and see it as a global war for talent, not a war against France or Germany for talent.
You know, Correct. 2 years ago, I wouldn't have asked this question, but I'm curious what impact patriotism is going to have on this discussion. Because there's a lot of American pride in America. And I would say that it feels like Europe, given the current tensions between my nation and the bloc, is changing its perspective on the US. And so, Harry, I wonder, are people going to be a little bit more, I was born in Europe, I'm going to build in Europe, just given the squabbling, you might say, amongst our various governments?
I don't think so. I think people will fundamentally do what's right for them and what feels best for them in the moment. But that's, again, our job, to create the environment that tells them you can. Like, a doom loop is a very dangerous thing. You know, it's a bit like trust. When it starts, it really goes, and it goes fast. And when it gains fast. And so it can be very good or dangerous. And, you know, the doom loop started here and the world suddenly picked up on it. And so for me, it was a case of how do we try and interject and reverse that so that people do feel a sense of patriotism to build here and realize they can.
Okay, then is 10 million euro enough to actually slow the doom loop or perhaps even stop it entirely?
One, I think the biggest problem that we've had over the last years is that we've stuffed too much cash into people too early. And so I think it's hilarious that people are saying we should have had more. Listen, could we have done more? Are you kidding me? I went out for 25 founders. That was the only... I went out for 25 founders who would be mentors. I got 150 in 3 days. Since I've had another... I honestly don't know, but at least another double that. So the money was not the issue. It's about choosing unbelievable talent, not just spraying money around, but choosing unbelievable talent, giving them enough to start to feel like they can build a great business, be mentored by an unbelievably successful founder one-to-one. The mentors only have one other. This is not like any other like program where you have like, oh, 10. This is one-to-one. Oh my God, if I had the chance to have Jason as a mentor when I was starting 20 VC, I have so many things I would do differently, I'm sure. And so that's very different. And so honestly, the money thing I think is just ridiculous.
I mean, it's actually great to start at 10 million because what you can do is say, here's the cohort. There were 50 of them. And all we need is but one to actually get to Series A to make this worth it. Because the economic viability of a Series A company, you know, that raises 5, 10, 15 million, it's going to shower, you know, that amount of taxes, economic activity. I know this because this founder university that we do, which is like a pre-accelerator for people before they actually have a product or an idea. We have only 40% pull through. But because you're starting so early, you don't need to have 80% pull through like you might want from a seed fund or a Series A fund. You can have a larger number of experiments. And if you frame it as experiments, then you've got the right framing. What's going to happen? I'll predict the next thing. They're attacking you on the age thing, which you can mitigate and say, we're focused on first-time founders, and we're trying to get them to not go into corporate America for the first job, but to start their entrepreneurial journey early. So that's our focus, our ideal customer. But we're open to a 70-year-old, of course. If they want to like do it when in their retirement, we'll take a look, sure. And then you just negate the whole thing. And then you just do whatever the hell you want. They're going to go after you next for, oh my God, you know, 45 of these went to zero. And it's like, look at the second companies. How many of those 45 that the experiments didn't work out, how many of those then did a second company?
Do you know what's insane? It's like, yes, we made a lot of noise with it. Did I know we would? Yes. I get distribution like you guys do. I knew that when we had 150 big names pump this, it would be very, very visible. But what's unbelievable is when we invest in companies, every single one of those partners who's invested is really keen to follow on, is really keen to keep track of it. As an 18-year-old building a AI company in Vienna, I now have 150 of the biggest founders in Europe literally following my story who will support me and promote my company. That's insane.
It's pretty great. All right, listen. Keep at it. You're great. You're awesome. Ignore the haters. They make you greater. And congratulations on all the success. And I can't wait to see you soon. And if Europe doesn't want these fine, amazing founders, come to Austin. I'll take you to 3 different barbecue joints. We'll hang out, come by the ranch. Entrepreneurs from Europe. Beautiful here. Cost of living's half of any city in Germany. Tons of young people, tons of freedom. You can get a gun, you can get a ranch, you can get a horse.
Alex, I've never been invited to this trip.
You're so consider yourself invited. Come anytime.
Right, well,
we'll,
there
do
we
a,
go.
We'll do you're a crossover get taping. Anytime me, you're ready. Anytime you're ready. I don't know if we're letting people from the UK in the country right now. We'll let you know if we're, we'll have to see. I have a friend who wants to go to Europe for the summer and he's staying for more than 2 weeks. His visa got turned down. Now there's a European visa in the summer. Is this true? The EU makes you, as an American, fill out a visa to go? Did you hear about this?
I don't really leave the studio these days.
We'll address it on a future episode, but yeah, there's a thing where I guess because the European cities were getting too crowded in the summers, like Italy and all the, you know, coastal places, that now you have to file for a visa and they might want to be controlling the stampede of Americans coming to, you know, what they consider Epcot Center. You know, it's like a part of Disneyland. to see like the old world, and with maybe too many of us coming for July 4th weekend. You're awesome. I'll see you soon, H2.
Amazing. See you.
Bye.
Awesome. He's great. You know?
Oh, talk about just like showing up and just doing stuff. Like, I mean, I was going to squeeze in one more before we let him go, but we didn't have time. But why hasn't anyone done this before? Hearing him talk about it, it just makes so much sense.
I mean,
sense.
In Europe, I mean, listen, there's a million programs here in the U.S. because in the U.S., people can do crazy. You can just do things. This is the most important thing for people to understand. You can just do things. You don't need permission. Go just do things. If it doesn't work out, who cares? Come to Austin. I'm sorry. For people, it's so funny. Whenever I tell people how great Austin is, they come up to me and they're like, don't say that. Tell them it's too hot. Tell them that there's seed of fever. We have to gatekeep this. There's too many people coming here. Listen, Austin's had 3% immigration every year. And they, as J.D. Vance just said, he tweeted, like, how can a place that has like, that's growing, have the rents go down and have housing prices go down what will be 3 years in a row? It's because they keep building supply, dummies.
They keep building supply.
Duh.
Having lived in San Francisco for a long time, I have such a deep-seated viewpoint on this. And yes. I want to take everyone who's a NIMBY and slowly push them into the ocean.
Exactly.
Well, you're killing us.
And it's even worse. It's even worse in the Bay Area because rich people buy the lot next to them. Like Zuckerberg, famously, you can look it up. He bought so many of the houses around him that Palo Alto was like, what's the plan for those houses? And he's like, oh yeah, I'm renovating them. And it's like, it's year 8 of the renovations. Did you file renovations? But he's like, no, I'm thinking about it or whatever. Like he was kind of slow rolling it. And all he was doing, from my understanding, I don't know if this is true, is buying every time a house became available, he buys it. So here it is. In 2013, Mark Zuckerberg purchased 4 homes surrounding his Palo Alto residence, spending over $30 million. He paid more than they were worth. And we call this, 35. They call this like negative population growth. The density in the Bay Area is going down because rich people are buying the home next to you. I almost did this. And then I kind of checked myself and I'm like, am I just buying the home next to me because I can? And then somebody can't live there and raise their family. And then, you know, I got a couple of homes for sale in the Bay Area and I don't need to sell them. I could sit on them. I could rent them, whatever. And I was like, you know what? I want these homes to be free for other families to have them. And it's selfish for me. It's not like a ski house in a ski town. It's like, do people want to live in ghost towns? And you know what? New York, a lot of the sky rises and lofts are filled with Russian, Chinese money being parked in Manhattan. And they're ghost towns. And people are like, I have a deli downstairs. I'm trying to sell egg, bacon, and cheese, and nobody will buy it. Let's keep going through the stock because I got to get on a plane. And there's a couple of other things going around here that we should talk about. Any good startup news? I need some startup news. Or maybe any startup lessons. You know, I love a good startup lesson.
Well, why don't we do kind of both at the same time here? I want to talk about barbelling because I think this is the new term of art. And so starting with a tweet from 2024, Ed Sim from Bold Start put out this tweet and he said,
"He's great.
People are doing one of two things at the seed stage. They're raising less than $2 million, as little as possible, or they're raising $10 million plus to go as big as fast as they can." And this tweet, I remember from when it came out, but then recently YC just had their demo day and there's been a lot of commentary from folks about what they're seeing today. And keep in mind, Jason, every YC demo day since time immemorial has involved people complaining about prices and people raising too much. However, things have changed. So here is Nicole Wiskoff of Wiskoff VC talking about the YC demo day that just happened. And she says she's seen barbell round dynamics, either a party round with angels and small feeler checks, or they're going to go out there and raise a crazy round. Solo founders with revenue and no plans to hire more people, even with more cash, are also part of the trend. So to me, we are seeing small team size, AI efficiency, allow people to build more faster with less money. And on the other side, people raising boatloads of cash. Your thoughts?
Static team size. We've talked about it before in the large companies, and that will be, replaced by compressing. Yeah, workforce compression's coming. We've seen the static team size, you know, at places like Uber, Meta, DoorDash, whatever, you know, just get 30% more efficient every year and have your growth be 30% and keep the team size the same, earnings go through the roof. Which is why even if we're in a recession or they're trying to have a recession, I think owning equities is like this is the greatest buying opportunity ever because these companies are so dynamic that they're going to be like, okay, what's the game on the field? Oh, 18 price earnings averages, 20 and not 25. That's fine. We'll just increase the amount of earnings we have and we'll get our valuation back. So people are dynamic in that way. And so, sure, and it's not that founders are deciding they want to go one way or the other. In a lot of cases, the market will tell them. So you go out and you say, here's my vision. And all, you know, there's a small number of VCs. The number of Series A's is incredibly low. These large rounds are incredibly low because it's a lot of startups. And so VCs might, you know, have a really hard time just dealing with the number of companies. So they pick one. So that makes it appear as though that founder chose to raise $10 million. And this other founder chose to just bootstrap it. And this other founder chose to raise, you know, $1 million. And keep it small and dilute 5 or 10 or 15%. The other one decided to go big. The other one decided to raise nothing. It might also be that they got a certain reaction from the market. And the market gives them a reaction that could be correct. It could be incorrect. Draymond Green was taken in the second round of the draft. I think Jalen Brunson was taken in the second round of the draft. And he's MVP candidate. So you can look it up, somebody. The, you know, there's many all-stars in the NBA who were taken in the second round. You know how much money is spent scouting who should go, which 30 players should go in the first round versus the second round? It's
insane.
Insane amounts of research and time and effort are put into that, and they can't get it right. Same holds true for VCs. The hand-wringing, you know, it's always been there. In a hot market, things get overvalued. And what I'll tell angels is, I always get asked, and you can read my book, when you're starting out as an angel investor in early stage, if you go to Y Combinator demo day, it's been designed to be a high pressure to get dentists and other folks to make snap decisions, which is fine. You know, it's a little bit of gamesmanship, which is fine. All's fair. These are rich people. And literally, they build the demo day around the dentist crowd. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way, but people with a lot of money who are like, hey, I would like to get involved in this game. And they're not exactly the most sophisticated, and they put high pressure tactics on them, rounds closing. Here's a piece of advice to you. Go meet 50 people at demo day and then check in with them in 6 months and then see where they're at. Much better strategy for a first time investor. Maybe make one investment, see how you do. But what you'll find is of those 50 companies, 49 out of 50 are still willing to take your money. So don't ever feel pressure as an investor. And then the second thing is of 1,000 founders who say, I'm going to start a company and I'm going to build a product. Maybe 100 of them actually release the product. Of the 100 that release the product, maybe 10 of them actually get to revenue. So 1,000 to 10, 1%, right? Actually get a customer that pays them money. My best advice for first year investors is only deal with that 1%. Only give your money if you're going to make 10 bets. That on the 10 that get the first customer. Why? You've now eliminated the 90 that never get their product to market, the 90%, and then the next 99% that never get a customer. If you just do that one thing, your portfolio will be incredibly different, incredibly different. And these overvalued high cap situations that happen in the pressure cooker, the artificial scarcity that's created in a demo day, that artificial scarcity that's created results in an elevation of valuations that eventually comes back down or stays the same a year later. The round is flat a year later. They're still raising on the same note, but they've got the one customer or maybe 10 or 20. Mm-hmm. So you can basically make a more intelligent bet. In poker, Alex, this would be like you get ace nine offsuit and you're out of position. And you say, you know what? I'm gonna fold this. I'll let other people play. I'll take a couple of notes. I'll have a sip of my coffee. Maybe I'll go use the bathroom real quick in this tournament. And then you come back and you're in position and you've got ace queen suited. And just that little tweak, ace nine off, ace queen suited, doesn't seem that dramatic. Take out the tables. Look at how those hands play in position, out of position. It's a pretty big gap. And that's what will happen in portfolio management. Go buy the book Angel. Tell me what you think. It's $15. It's a lot of knowledge.
I want to
Angel University, April 23rd in New York. If you want to go angel.university, all proceeds go to charity.
I want to say though, I think that this is, I agree with you on people are reacting to the market. I agree with you that there's always hand-wringing. But when I read this tweet from Terrence Rohan, he's a seed investor. I think he put money into Figma. He says, the founder of a top YC company in the current batch on venture capital, and this is a quote, "People used to climb Everest and they needed oxygen. Today, people climb it without oxygen. I want to summit Everest and use as little oxygen, venture capital, as possible." He calls it a vibe shift.
Yeah.
And I just think that this is going to change a little bit the relationship between, you know, venture investors, angels, and the dentist crowd and startups, because it does feel like we've had, you know, we had Roy on the other day and you're like, "Roy, I want to bet on you." And he's like, "Oh, I'm already a millionaire ARR." Like, that's a different world than it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, when you and I were still going to every YZ demo day.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's, I don't have the right words yet or phrasing or mental framework around the new model, but I think the combination of AI powered tools, cheaper than ever, cloud infra to build, infinite distribution, and people just able to do a lot. The old model of SaaS and building expensive enterprise sales teams just feels archaic in the modern moment. And so things really do feel fresh. And I love that.
Yeah, cost structures change. And you know what? We saw it, you know, in content. And so we had an all-in content summit here at South by Southwest yesterday. And this was like one of the big topics. I was talking to a friend of mine, Chris Williamson, who's a podcaster, and Samir and Colin, or Colin and Samir. And they're like a content shop where they sell people courses on how to do great content and build businesses. And it turns out most of the talented people are now having 10 person under teams making millions of dollars, like we're doing here, or, you know, at All In. And you watch somebody like Megyn Kelly or Tucker Carlson, they can do what they do with under 10 people and they have complete control and they keep their costs low. And then you look at Fox. Fox has shareholders. So shareholders have to get a dividend, right? So that's going to be some percentage of the overall revenue. Then they have management. Management setting the strategy. They have to get a percentage of the revenue. Then they have a building. And then they have people. And then they have high-priced studios. And if you look at the output, Megyn Kelly doing her show on YouTube with a laptop and a regular old camera, a couple of lights, probably no camera operators. Whereas when she was in studio, there were probably 15 people operating the lights, cameras, and in that switching room. All of that gets abstracted away, which means you don't have to make as much money to, and you can have bigger impact and you have more optionality. So what we've seen in content, where one person, or, you know, a team of under 10, three people, 10 people, they can have more impact and it's more lightweight, have less infrastructure, less overhead. It always starts with startups. Startups are scrappy, and so are content creators because they're entrepreneurs. They try to take a nickel and get a dollar of value. And that is the new model. And you're starting to see some of the big companies say, "Okay, maybe I'm not going to do that, but I'd like to get a dollar out of a dollar." Instead, as opposed to spending $10 and get a dollar of value, or our government spend $100, get a dollar of value. The age of accountability is here. If you want to compete as a startup, you got to be accountable to that bottom line, and then you're more defensible. He's Alex Wilhelm. I'm Jason Calacanis, and this has been another amazing episode of This Week in Startups. We'll see you all on Monday. Have a great, restful weekend, or build your startup. And if you are building your startup, go to founder.university. We're going to have our 10th class, some big announcements from Founder University. And we're going to invest in 10 companies on the way in, either the 25K first check or the 125K more accelerator check. So we're going to try to invest in 10 companies coming in. So make sure you apply, founder.university, check the box that you want to get funded on the way in, or you could be one of the 30 companies that we invest in during the program. We're trying to hit 500 companies in this cohort. We're trying to hit 5,000 applications, which is roughly double what we normally do. We're trying to scale the program. We're trying to write more 25K first checks, and we're willing to take that risk. The question is, are you willing to get two of your friends or two random people who are, you know, builders? And are you willing to take the risk? Let us know. Founder.university.
Love it. Bye, everybody.